You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, June 10th, a Matt and Michael Monday.
That's right, and we are broadcasting live from the, I can't believe
from
I'm having
the
a
fashionable
lunch district of New York City.
In the literal...
We're off, sorry. We are broadcasting live from the shadow, the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Wow.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And I'm Matt Binder.
This is the award-winning Majority Report.
And our soundboard levels are peaking all over the place. Give me a second here.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a hectic past couple of days, folks, both personally and nationally. The weather here in New York City is awful. I don't know about you, but I've been getting soaked every single day I've come into work, I feel like, for the past at least week. A lot coming up on the show today. Professor Juan Cole, who is one of America's foremost experts on the Middle East, national security. He's going to be talking with us about these explosive revelations that just keep on coming out.
This has been quite the weekend.
It really has been.
News. I mean, yesterday in itself, I mean, the NSA whistleblower has spoken out, and it is a 29-year-old. Edward Snowden was his name. And he's currently in Hong Kong, trying to not get sent back to America.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice. We'll talk more about why he might be in Hong Kong. I find that interesting. We'll also be talking about these same topics with Professor Cole, obviously. In some ways, I think what's interesting, we were talking about this before we went on air, is the kind of breakdown of who's on what side of this equation and the kind of, you know, statist national security Republicans and the
Obama apologists,
diehard Obama people.
They want to see this guy extradited and prosecuted to the fullest extent, and it's just bizarre.
Yeah, it's really.
I mean, some of these people are even calling for Glenn Greenwald to be prosecuted, as if he was the same thing.
Who's actually called for Glenn? I actually haven't seen that, to be honest.
I'll pull it up during the break. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. So and then the libertarians, and then the kind of, you know, I guess we're like left wing civil libertarians. So it's an interesting kind of breakdown of the fault lines here of this story, and I think more is probably coming. So there's that. I'm also going to talk with Professor Cole about demonstrations, which have been rocking Turkey for a little over a week now. That's also a really, really big story. Very interesting. A lot of implications there. Atheist prayers in Arizona on the other side of the equation. That's a pretty amusing and unbelievable story that we'll get to later. And also, it wouldn't be a week without genuinely important revelations in the news, without Alex Jones making an ass of himself and proving once again why the fact that people listen to him and his ilk is really nothing but bad.
But the thing about this audio we have is it's crazy. We're going to play it. But I feel like other media outlets are starting to you know, encroach on our niche.
They're doing the crazy patrol too.
That's,
well, actually, what's interesting about this clip is that this is a clip from, he was on a show in the BBC in the UK And he was literally crazy patrolled in real time. But anyways, folks, we're going to get right to Juan Cole. We're going to take a brief break. Tune in. We'll be back in a moment with Professor Juan Cole. Thanks so much. Welcome back. I'm Michael Brooks, filling in for Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. Joining us now is Professor Juan Cole. He blogs at Informed Comment. He's a professor at the University of Michigan and really one of the most foremost authorities of the Middle East and national security in the United States, in my view, and the cause of me sounding really particularly and exceptionally informed at dinner parties sometimes about the Middle East. How are you, Professor Cole?
Just fine. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
Good to be back.
glad to have you back. And that does sound much, much better. So as I was saying before we got cut off, you have a new post that you wrote kind of comparing the political culture around Second Amendment protections or fanatical interpretations of Second Amendment for, protections as related to gun rights, obviously, and the kind of political constituency of the gun lobby, versus as our willingness to kind of continually erode and roll back Fourth Amendment protections, which is exactly what these disclosures have kind of highlighted over the past couple of days. And you say that there isn't a kind of similar corporate constituency that's interested in those types of protections. And you know, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm just wondering if you could kind of elaborate on that.
Well, sure. Well, you know, there are about four big manufacturers of pistols, of handguns, Glocks, and so forth. And then there are a limited number of manufacturers of assault weapons. And they're making billions off of this stuff. And so whenever we have these school shootings or massacres carried out, and they can only be carried out on, you know, on a mass level with those kinds of semi-automatic weapons.
Sure.
Whenever there's a public debate about whether something could be done about this or should be done about this, and we have 30,000 gun deaths a year if you count the suicides, it's shut down. And we saw recently that even a democratically controlled Senate couldn't even report out any kind of reform on this issue, and it's because politicians get elected by campaign contributions from corporations, and there are lobbies like the National Rifle Association that act as pass-through for these huge arms manufacturers. So they just shut down the debate on this because they have a very strong interest in a fundamentalist and somewhat, you know, ahistorical and weird interpretation of the Second Amendment, that everybody has a right to semi-automatic weapons and huge ammunition rolls attached. But with regard to the Fourth Amendment, which forbids the government to search through our personal effects and papers to come on our property without a warrant from a judge and without a very narrow specification of what exactly they're looking for and what is the reason for which they suspect that a criminal act is being committed. With regard to the Fourth Amendment, there's been no effective pushback at all from the corporations in Congress with regard to lobbying and so forth on preserving those rights. There's nobody that makes money off of preventing intrusions into our personal privacy.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems quite the contrary. In fact, there's a lot of money to be made in pretty intrusive data mining and other technologies that sort of violate our privacy on a pretty regular basis. And then what we've seen here is this kind of parallel between maybe some of the more encroaching habits of some Silicon Valley firms and then what the NSA has been doing. And obviously that's kind of highlighted in this PRISM program. You had there's sort of two parts of this that I kind of wanted to get to. One is that, and I think it relates very directly to the kind of corporate component, because the firms, the Silicon Valley firms, have denied pretty not very – it sounds blunt, but actually if you kind of read it, it's a very parsed denial of having a role in these programs in terms of giving the NSA direct access to their servers. There's, you know, the other possibilities that the NSA asks directly for access, and they're granted on a particular basis or with specific requests, like with the phone records, or the other possibilities that they're kind of being filtered through a third party. But I guess what I'm curious for you about is this kind of disparity between the kind of expansion of government overreach and then the kind of extreme limits that we're also placing on ourselves, both in our private and public lives when we interact with these companies or when we're being monitored by the government, that how that sort of parallel is playing out.
Yes, well, of course, the internet companies, some of them have aspirations of developing a kind of hologram of each of us that they would know all of our likes and dislikes, our location. At one point, the head of Google wanted to have it be such that if you were out of town, you were visiting another city, that Google could tell you where your favorite restaurant was probably, and then which cinema house you might like to go to, and so forth. In order to commercialize the internet,
right,
they would like to have total information awareness about their customers, just as the U.S. government would like to have total information awareness about its citizens. And so those two things work together, and in fact, one justifies the other. So very often, National Security Agency or CIA or other officials, when pressed on government intrusions into our electronic privacy, will say, well, we give away that information quite freely to Jeff Zuckerberg or to Google, so why would we mind so much if the government also gets it?
Right, right. And I think then that the sort of notion as well that this kind of encroachment has been a portrayal by President Obama of kind of his affinity for geek culture or the technology industry. In fact, it hasn't been a betrayal. It's actually run, as you say, quite parallel to the policies of these companies. Obviously, you know, this is sort of happening in the context, this is happening in the context of the Bradley Manning trial. And you said that really what this guy, Snowden, has done and what Bradley Manning did is sort of turn the tables on what government has been doing to us. And I was curious if you could elaborate on that as well.
Sure. Well, there's now a government class.
Right.
There's a class of people with security clearances who can dip in to your privacy at will without a warrant,
right,
under certain circumstances. It's not that they can necessarily listen to your phone calls without a warrant. But there are various forms of surveillance that they can put people under at will. And so essentially there's a class of people because of their government connections, and many of these, by the way, are contractors. Right. They have security clearances, but they're being provided to the government by private firms. So it's not just government employees. So that you what
well,
you
like
call
the like the leaker himself. I mean, he was an employee of Booz Allen, right?
Yes, that's right. He at the time that he became aware of PRISM. And when he blew the whistle on it, he wasn't a direct employee of the U.S. government. But he had, he says that he could, if Barack Obama was using a Gmail account, that he could just go look at the emails, even of the president. In any case, this sort of surveillance class exists with security clearances and access to these monitoring technologies. And the rest of us are second class. We don't have access to that. We don't know what they're doing. So, you know, President Obama came out on Friday and said, well, now that this is out, would he be glad to have a debate? It seemed to me one of the worst moments of his presidency because it was so disingenuous that he had not allowed us to have a debate because all of these programs and activities are secret and classified. And indeed, Ron Wyden, who represents Oregon in the Senate, knew about it and could not reveal it to us. He could sort of signal that we wouldn't like it if we knew what was going on, but that was the limit of what he could say. So we couldn't have a debate because everything is classified, and even bringing it up is now being portrayed as a kind of treason. So what these whistleblowers are doing is subjecting the surveillance class to the kind of monitoring and surveillance of them by the public that they do to the public every day.
Yeah, it's a kind of almost informational equivalent of the kind of 99% versus the 1%, and it's an interesting and disturbing parallel. There's two more questions I wanted to get with you, get to you on this theme. One, going back to President Obama. I agree with you. I think that it was an incredibly disingenuous and unfortunate moment. But I think it was there's a continuity there. That's the same attitude he's taken on drones and covert actions abroad, which is hold information incredibly tightly, try to keep these programs as under wraps as possible, and then as sort of they emerge, then he kind of adopts this, I want a kind of open society, big debate position. And what do you make of that as a political habit he's making for himself in terms of every time these things emerge, immediately adopting a position which seems directly contradictory of what he has been, in fact, practicing?
Yeah, well, I like President Obama quite a lot and support most of his policies, but he, like Bill Clinton, really has a blind spot on security issues, and it may come with being in the office. I don't know, I think he spent a lot of time in Chicago being a community organizer and has been slammed for that background. But what a community organizer does is go to a community and try to help them figure out what they want and how to get it. And so I think when a really controversial issue arises. Obama, and he did this with health care and with gun control and so forth, instead of being presidential and sort of leading and making decisions and taking on interests, he falls into this community organizer mode, and he says, well, okay, so we've got a nation that's divided and there are different views. What do you really want and how could we help you to get it? I think it's just his background that leads him to think that way.
So you think it's his background to sort of adopt this kind of multi-stakeholder and synthesis approach, which is okay.
I think it's a flaw in him with regard to being president, because a smart president who wanted health care in the United States would have had a bill written and taken it to Nancy Pelosi and Reid and said, "Pass this."
Right.
But he didn't. He called the Republicans in and said, "How could we make you happy?"
Right. No, that's precisely, what he did. Absolutely. I mean, I guess the one way that I might push back on that a bit, though, is I do think with healthcare, the process was flawed, but he was pushing it in a certain direction, whereas it does seem with some of these security policies, almost reading him in retrospect, even when he was critical when he campaigned, was he critical not of any of the substance of these programs, but in the kind of lawless and cavalier way that the Bush administration did them. And he all along has been pretty comfortable about kind of implementing and carrying out these relatively, you know, kind of aggressive approaches to surveillance and covert actions. So that I kind of wonder about.
Yeah, well, he's very devoted to that. And, yeah, of course, he campaigned against Bush that he wasn't using drones enough. So
right,
he has a hardline side to him, which people sometimes don't realize. And again, you know, if you were, you know, elected a Democratic president after a long time of Republican rule, and the bureaucracy's full of Bush appointees, and you're afraid of information being used against you in invidious ways, this cult of secrecy that he and Holder have, and this intolerance of whistleblowing, and this fear, really, of information being used to manufacture scandals, I think comes out of this long period in the wilderness that the Democrats had, and the awareness that the Republicans are perfectly willing to play these games. And I think,
well,
there have been public officials who have been damaged by these kinds of techniques.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. I think the another important question to kind of get to hopefully sort of wrap this section up, though, and I think it's important to reflect on, is it seems to me that, and maybe I'm being a bit like President Obama myself here, but I hear these two kind of dominant threads when we talk about terrorism and whether or not these programs are justified. And then I kind of one extreme, you know, there's the kind of September 11th repeater brigade, and, you know, Al-Qaeda's at your doorstep. Terrorism is the most kind of vital national security threat we've ever faced. And then on the other extreme, maybe there's some people who would tend to, in the process of rightly criticizing some of these policies, I think personally to a degree overlook the fact that, no, there actually are legitimate and real security challenges that the United States faces from groups like Al-Qaeda, and President Obama does legitimately need to make some hard decisions about. And I'm just wondering what your sort of overall take is now on what is the quality of that threat to the United States right now?
Well, I think the real issue is whether these techniques actually are productive.
Right.
Because I'm of a school with regard to counterterrorism, and I've done consulting on counterterrorism. I'm very committed to it. I'm not a bleeding heart liberal in that regard. I think, you know, if we've got evidence that somebody's trying to kill our children, we have a responsibility to act first.
Right.
But I think the police work of detective work is how you roll those things up. And the idea that you're going to break up Al-Qaeda by data mining all of Verizon's records for 3 months.
Right.
Just strikes me as daft. I mean, it's typical of a kind of blind faith in quantitative methods that
right.
dominates some of our social science now too, as well as counterterrorism. And while I don't have a security clearance, so I don't know. I mean, I couldn't tell you if any very serious threat has ever been rolled up because they keep these things secret in this way. I'd be very surprised. And the ones that we know about, you know, we didn't get bin Laden that way.
Right.
We haven't gotten Ayman al-Zawahiri that way.
Right.
The big threats that we know about that have been broken up haven't been because of this kind of surveillance. And even, I think, big mistakes are made because that's another thing that this kind of surveillance can go wrong easily. For instance, those Yemeni boys up at Lackawanna, New York, they were under email surveillance, and some of them went to a wedding in Bahrain, said it's going to be a really big feast. And, you know, the New York Times revealed that the intelligence analysts were wondering, you know, is feast a code word for a bomb? And but no,
right.
you know, they were going to a wedding. So
feast was a feast.
There are all kinds of drawbacks in just casting a wide net.
Right, and I think for that matter, the successes have not been reflected as far as we know in these programs, and the failures, have, such as what happened in Boston, were not anticipated by these programs either. So that point is very well taken. I want to move, just for the final section of this, to Turkey. Protests there are ongoing, And I'm curious, just for our listeners, what was the kind of impetus behind the protest? What launched them, and what was the sort of initial response of the Turkish government?
Well, the initial protest was about a park in the European part of Istanbul. It was green, and the trees were 70 years old, and the current government in Turkey is more or less a neoliberal government. That is to say, it values the market as a way of getting social work done. Right. And so plans were made to turn that nice green park into a mall. You know, it would be like putting the Mall of America in Central Park in New York. Not exactly on that scale, but that's just to give you an idea of what was going on. So there were people who were attached to that green space, and the area around it, by the way, is a kind of bohemia. It's a kind of place where people gather in the evening to sit at cafes and drink beer, and there are nightclubs and tea houses where folk music is played. So it's a kind of counterculture, bohemia kind of atmosphere. There's also retail. It's all mixed up together. So, but I think people, in part, were not only protesting against those trees being torn down and the green space going away, but they were protesting that it was being done by fiat from the prime minister's office, and they were protesting against a general sense of regimentation, of police brutality, of being pushed around by central government, which is not new with this government. The AKP government that's in power now is not very different from its predecessor in those regards. But there's a, you know, there's a growing middle class in Turkey, educated, hooked in with the world, who just minds that kind of regimentation. And so that was part of what was being protested.
Yeah, so it's interesting to me, you know, in terms of Turkey, because basically in my understanding of the Turkish context is that the AKP government came into power, I believe, in 2003. And this was, I think, yes, it's a neoliberal party. It's also it's an Islamic party, but I would say it's much more it's better to think of it in terms of maybe like Christian Republicans in the United States, much more analogous to that than something like than something like Saudi Arabia or another kind of very extreme. It's a religious party or a religious government. It's not like that at all. But there is this certain religious conservatism and market focus in the party. And it seemed that the opposition to them for a long time in Turkey came from kind of remnants of the older secular order, which probably had some legitimate criticisms but didn't have a great democratic record itself and kind of resented being usurped. But it seems like what's happening now, there's an environmental component to this. There's an emerging middle class component to this. There's a broader kind of more genuine liberal thing happening. That's been my read on it. Is that a fair read?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a very canny analysis. I think once the government pushed back so harshly against the protesters over the park issue, that it set the young people's nerves on edge. Now, one thing to say is that the people involved in the protests are young. These are 20-somethings for the most part, right? And a lot of them were just kids when this government came to power. It's been elected three times. It came to power first in 2002. And so they've grown up with it, and some of them are tired of it. But they're tired of the regimentation. And you know, the soccer fans in Turkey are kind of rowdy, and a lot of them are, you know, they're not religious people, let us say. And so although they might not be committed secularists, they mind the religious tinge. And the government in Turkey, although it has origins in Muslim movements, it's most of its policies have not been particularly religious. They have been conservative. So, but recently, the prime minister announced that you couldn't buy beer after 10. There would be an early last call.
Oh.
Well, you know, there are a lot of countries where you can't order after 11. So it's not the end of the world, maybe. But a lot of the young people you know, took it as a symbol that there's this starting to, because this, alcohol is forbidden in Islam, and maybe this is the beginning of that kind of regimentation. Or, and you know, they put restrictions on abortion. Just, I think the analogy you made to the religious right in the United States is very apt. So it's, yeah, as you say, it's nothing like Saudi Arabia or Iran or anything like that. It's a secular country. It's got a secular constitution, and the party, you know, hasn't really pushed Islamic issues, but at the margins, it's pushed, you know, kind of social conservatism. So a lot of the young people are pushing it back against that. And then once the crackdown began, some of the labor unions joined in and announced strikes. And the labor unions in Turkey are very weak. They were destroyed by the old secular military government. But they still are there as, you know, weak shadows of their former selves. And so they seem to be galvanized by this, and they're mobilizing again against the neoliberal emphasis of the government of you know, it's encouraged real estate speculation. The property keeps getting high. People can't afford to keep their apartments. There's all these new buildings going up and malls, and you know, in some ways it's progress, but it has victims.
Right, and there is this neoliberal flavor, and I guess what I'm curious about, and I know you have to be, obviously, one has to be very careful in kind of drawing these sort of comparisons, and the movements, you know, I obviously in a place like Egypt are radically different than something like Occupy, and are different than something that's going on in Turkey, but I think what's interesting that's happening now is it seems to me that this is the first type of movement that we've seen in what maybe could be called a second world country, or a, you know, a developing and growing place that's not quite conventionally first world yet, or however we want to use those terms. But there is this kind of heavy backlash in some respects towards neoliberalism in Turkey. And do you think that it's obviously specific to the Turkish situation, but is that connected with currents in Europe and the rest of the Middle East? Does it say something broader beyond the Turkish situation?
Well, I think that, you know, we could now start talking about a whole string of youth anti-neoliberalism movements. There was one in Israel, right, in the summer of 2011, yeah. And it was about apartment rents for young people to some extent, and it had a great success. It was one of the most important recent Israeli social movements. The indignados, the indignant ones in Spain, you know, have some similarities,
right?
And they also were protesting neoliberalism, and especially the way, you know, neoliberalism is very much implicated in the real estate collapse and the economic collapse in Spain, even though many of those policies were pursued by a socialist government, that the policies themselves were somewhat neoliberal.
Right.
And so in Chile, you've had huge demonstrations. The government was headed by a billionaire and wanted to raise the fees for education, and the students came back and said, "Well, no, we want free education." I mean, that's a typical neoliberal kind of move on the government's part to have education be a market, right, in which
right.
people would pay for the certification as middle class people, so as to raise their incomes in life. And and the young people were arguing that no, education is like water; it's a public good; it should be free. And there's just been enormous student demonstrations in Chile, Colombia as well. So I mean, these things don't get a lot of press because they don't seem obviously connected to one another. And while they can be quite large and quite significant domestically, they don't seem to have a lot of international resonances. But I think since 2008, there have been fair numbers of these things, and that Turkey's has many similarities to the others.
Oh, that's fascinating. And the final question on Turkey, do you think, it seems to me, you know, Prime Minister Erdogan, you know, I've heard him compared to a Turkish George W. Bush. He's very confident. He's well, unlike Bush, he did win genuine large election victories. But his response has been to call the protesters vandals, hooligans, be pretty dismissive. Other ministers in his government have actually taken a much more conciliatory tone. Do you think that that's good cop, bad cop, or is there a genuine possibility of some different instincts inside the AKP, AKP government, and how do you think this might all sort of turn out?
Oh, I think the AKP government is very internally divided, and that Erdogan has a particular point of view on things coming from his own biography.
Right.
You know, he was once put in jail by the old secular military government for reading a poem. And the poem likened minarets to spears.
Yes.
So the government charged him with terrorism and put him in jail.
Right.
And, you know, if you were a kind of a religious and observant Muslim in Turkey under the secular military government, you were not a happy camper. You know, girls couldn't go on college campuses or in public buildings with a veil. People were, you know, it wasn't like American secularism, which when the government's supposed to be neutral towards religious movements. It was like the French, where the government considered it religion to be like smoking. You know, it's a public health problem that should be discouraged. And so he fought all his life against this, what he saw as religious discrimination. And when he finally got into power and he won all these elections, he got real pushback. There was danger of a military coup from the secularists. So he thinks, as far as I can tell from his speeches, that the old secular party, the Republican People's Party, is secretly behind these demonstrations, that they're manifestations of a political plot against him to undo the results of democratic, free, and fair elections. This is just a kind of coup by protest.
Right.
And that's why he says things like, well, we'll teach them real politics, and about 7 months we'll have elections, and I'll beat the pants off them again. And so I think he doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't understand this is a youth movement. He doesn't understand why people would be upset about progress like a new mall instead of these old trees. So it's just his blinders, I think.
Right, but I guess to be fair, he does have a pretty unique political biography and some genuine accomplishments to his credit, and unfortunately he can't stay current and kind of anticipate what's going on now, maybe because of those blinders, as you say. Professor Cole, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate you having you on.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Great. Take good care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Professor Cole, what do you think?
He's always a great interviewer.
Yeah, he's
great. I mean,
great.
He really knows. I mean, of course. I mean, I have him on the show.
Yeah, no, he's just – I mean, but I think that that's really interesting just in terms of like – connecting the dots on these movements, you know, globally, against neoliberalism in some respects. And it was interesting. I was tiptoeing because I do see those connections, but obviously I want to hear what he has to say and not go out on a limb. And he seemed actually pretty genuinely optimistic about it, which was interesting to hear.
Whenever these movements happen, I always take a look and I'm always just so disappointed in the United States and people here. And they're just completely okay with things. I mean, even the most recent thing, Occupy Wall Street, I mean, majority of the people just didn't care. And it's just unbelievable to me.
I think, well, I mean, to be fair, though, it's never a majority of people that do these things. It's never a majority of people that
are on
the street.
But you always get like, you know, like when these protests or movements spark in other countries, you always get these pictures of these huge crowds, which we have here.
Yep.
But you also get the surrounding people supporting them, whether it's from their windowsills, just banging pots and pans, just doing something. I mean, here what you get is a poll that says, like, yeah, we support them. Like, you never see, like, people not actively involved, but just, like, you know, out there with words of encouragement. Like, I was a part of Occupy Wall Street. I covered it for the show, and I was with the movement as much as I could. And I feel like, you know, when we would march, the people who were not marching, the majority were either tourists taking pictures, which is cool, or Americans getting pissed at, oh, you're in my way, I'm trying to get to the store. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, how many people I saw with that attitude. And I guarantee you don't get that as much in other countries.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I don't know. It really, to be honest with you, it really, in my experience of being abroad, it really depends, because there's sometimes other, you know, situations like in Turkey where, you know, it's not just cops who are beating the crap out of some of these protesters. I'll put it to you that way. But I think on the other hand, which is interesting – go ahead.
The thing about that is this fight that's been going – that was going on either over the weekend or right before the weekend, like Thursday or Friday, where
the Prime Minister of Turkey. What's his name again?
Erdogan.
I always confuse how to say his name. Erdogan. Erdogan.
Erdogan.
Erdogan.
Yeah, you got it.
Erdogan. He was saying how, you know, 3 people died here. No big deal. 17 people died in America with Occupy Wall Street. The police killed 17 people in America by Occupy Wall Street. He said that with an exact number of 17. And the U.S. Embassy there came out online on Twitter and said, this is false. There was no deaths by police forces in the United States during Occupy Wall Street. And I mean, and then they went ahead to delete it, which was odd, too. They deleted their correction of the Turkish prime minister, which was bizarre. I mean, it was a factual. It is factual. But at the same time, it was bizarre seeing these two countries go at it as which country has the less oppressive police force.
I remember in 2011 when the crackdown started on Occupy Wall Street, there was the first crackdown in Egypt since the movement that had brought down Mubarak. And then several months later, there was, you know, without getting into the specific details, there was another crackdown. And the Egyptians said, look, you guys need to keep the streets safe in the United States. You know, so, I mean, yeah, when I think, you know, even when it's not directly analogous or the same thing by any stretch of the imagination, obviously, and I think especially what's interesting in Turkey, because, again, the response in Turkey has been really brutal and really bad. But Turkey has, as I say, Turkey's in, especially in urban Turkey, it's like a second world country. This isn't something like Egypt. It's obviously not anything like Syria. So it is much more comparable to how protesters are treated in the United States or Europe. And so he's definitely able to kind of get out and say, don't lecture me. Do we have time really quickly to get to this Alex Jones piece, or do we got to get to the better half?
I think we have to get to the better half.
We can't.
You know what?
We started
a little bit late. I don't know. What do you want to do? It's up to you.
You know what? Let's just do a few minutes of this Alex Jones.
All right, let's
Everybody has just learned so much and been so intellectually invigorated by listening to Professor Cole. Now let's plow through a few brain cells.
All right, why don't you give? While I pull it up, because I didn't get a chance to pull it. While I pull it up, why don't you just give a brief overview of what happened here?
So basically, the reason a number of people, mailed this in to the majorityreporters at gmail.com, which you can email. And basically, Alex Jones was in the UK over the weekend on a political talk program with a journalist named Alex Aronovich, I think his name was. He's a UK journalist who is actually – he writes about conspiracy theory culture. And the problems with it.
David Aronovich. The host of the show is Andrew Neil.
Andrew Neil. And this is like Politics Sunday on the BBC, I think the name of the show. Is the name of the show.
Sunday Politics.
Sunday
Politics. No, you got it.
I'm sorry, folks. I'm dyslexic with this story. But anyways, there's a Bilderberg group meeting in the UK right now. So Alex Jones is actually in the UK. Actually, on the set of this program, talking with this guy, David Aronovich, who is an anti-conspiracy theory person and the host of this show. And basically, there's two things about this that I think are relevant. We'll probably play a little bit of it. One, I just think it goes to repeat again that over a weekend, when you've had these incredibly important disclosures about the PRISM program and about this tremendous overreach of the U.S. surveillance state, that if ever there was a time to turn off the garbage and not listen to people like Alex Jones or Glenn Beck and really get serious about what's actually happening in your world and the complexities of it and the wrongs of it, now is the time. And then the other part that's funny about this, if we're going to play to the end, is that the British press doesn't sort of handle Alex Jones in the same way as the American press. They kind of seem to be less impressed by his theatrics or less intimidated. So it's kind of funny. If you play you ready to play some of this?
Yeah.
Let's listen to some. So they're talking about this Bilderberg group meeting that's happening in the UK right now, and Alex is trying to do his thing. So let's just play a little bit of this.
We haven't been acclimated yet.
Could you let him finish?
We're in a police state. It's 1984.
Yeah, listen,
you guys just want to normalize it.
Would you let him
Alex,
finish?
Alex, how come you're here?
If we're in a police state, how come
they actually turned back some of my reporters, but they didn't turn me back, and I was told this because they don't want to make a stink.
Do you think the BBC is part of the Bilderberg Group?
Well, you know, Winston Smith did work here. I mean, come on, Eric Blair worked here, and that's what he said it was.
Why do you think we've let you on? Why have we let you on then?
Because you guys think that you can manage the whole thing, and now our information's gotten too big. I have 3 million radio listeners a day. That's a low number. 3 million. I get about 50 million YouTube views a month. That's a very conservative number. I make films, put them online for free, that get watched 40 million times, like the Obama deception. That's why, because the establishment doesn't know what to do.
Alex has this point, and it's an important one. I would have, say, 10 years ago said, listen to all this stuff. He believes that people put cancer virus in vaccine in order to create a eugenics program. That's what he believes.
We talk about medical discoveries.
And we would have said, and I would have said, hey, that's kind of
positive.
He's mocking them.
If you notice,
on the BBC, what?
Alex Jones did this when he was on Piers Morgan. He did his little British accent, and he's going back into
it
again.
But that makes no sense when you're on BBC.
He's literally in the UK, in Britain, on the BBC, doing his British accent. Go ahead.
On, and it's an interesting psychological phenomenon.
Like
dismiss
Tuskegee,
it.
Like
the problem is Orton that down, conspiracy theories troops. Like this are believed in.
Hey, listen, I'm here to warn people. You keep telling me to shut up. This isn't a game, okay? Our government in the U.S. is building FEMA camps. We have an NDAA where they disappear people now. You have this arrest for public safety, life in prison.
You are the worst person I've ever interviewed.
No, it's basically off with their heads, disappear
David,
them,
thank
take
you
them
for
away.
Being with us.
Infowars.com.
Past 11. You're watching the
Liberty
Sunday Politics. We have an idiot
freedom
on the program
will not
today.
Stop. You
coming
will not
up
stop
in just
freedom.
20 minutes.
You will not stop the Republic. Humanity is awakening. Infowars.com. No, you guys are crazy.
I'll be looking at the week ahead with our political panel.
You're
until
crazy.
Then, the
think
Sunday
the
Politics across
know.
The
You're
UK.
Crazy. Think of the public isn't waking up.
Wow.
Applause all the way around. Applause for the BBC host.
We'll post this on YouTube. You have to see this part of the video at the end. He's shouting because they're cutting away to commercial. I mean, they just had him on for 9.5 minutes, which, I mean, that's long for a TV program. Yes.
Britain, they have a little bit longer segments. But, yeah, they gave him a long time.
And, I mean, they're cutting away. They didn't – I mean, he right away – he shouted, don't you try to interrupt me, before they even interrupted him.
No,
I mean, that was pretty bizarre.
No, it was amazing. And I just love that they're like, this man is an idiot. We'll be moving on. And then what's great about Alex Jones, and I'm going to just lay this marker down today to wrap this segment up. Number one, if for whatever reason anybody who watches this on YouTube or just comes across this, stop listening to this guy. Please stop wasting your time. It's garbage. Number two, he's playing you for a fool because I do think it's an act. I think when you go on a crazy rampage like that, but you're still saying your website over and over and over and over again.
Infowars.com!
You know,
Infowars.com!
I've never met like a crazy dude like, you know, on the street or something who's ranting and is like, and by the way, buy my book.
When Sam goes
Bill on. Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, Alex Jones, and Glenn Beck is the master. Everything is integrated product placement. Alex Jones is a fraud. Alex Jones is lying, and if you take him seriously, you're being played by a fool day in and day out while real things are happening in America and real things are happening in the world that are major problems.
When Sam goes on
another show. So wake up! Wake up! Stop listening to Alex Jones!
Right. When Sam goes on other shows, he'll come into this office the next day, and Michael and I will literally grill him like, dude, why didn't you mention the website more? Like, you didn't even say it once.
That's true.
Like that's like... There's people who don't want to push things because they want what they have to say to speak for itself. And then there's people who just throw out random subjects because they don't have the in-depth information, which is what Alex Jones did. How many different things did he mention in that? He threw out 20 different topics.
Including some real things, which is the problem.
But he never went in-depth with either of them because you know why? What he believes is going on, or what he wants you to believe is what's going on in there, isn't what's going on, and that's the problem.
That's exactly right. And actually, yeah, when Sam comes back, we're like, so, hey, how did it go? We kind of test him to see if he – because we lead up to the grilling by asking – because we already know that he hasn't promoted the site enough. So we say, hey, Sam, how was the blah, blah, blah? And he'll be like, oh, you know, there was good bagels in the green room or something. And you're just like, Sam, that was the major take. And then he'll say something that, like, another panelist said that was smart or stupid or something. But the point is that Cedar is not the machine that Alex Jones is. Alex Jones is a conspiracy empire. And look, I admire the hustle, but please, for your own good, just stop taking it seriously. All right, folks.
Time for the better half.
What do we have coming up in the better half?
In the better half, we've got this is my favorite story. I was pushing for Sam to get to it last week. He didn't get to, so I will do it. There is an insane thing happened in Arizona when an atheist lawmaker tried to do the day's prayer.
It's hilarious.
It's unbelievable. You just have to hear it. We also got this incredible story that just came out today with there's a guy who got arrested on a DUI. The only problem was he wasn't drunk.
There was another problem from an Arizona police point of view.
That was also in Arizona. We got two Arizona stories.
Which we will find out in the second half.
We got some more stuff. Also, I think we'll talk a little bit more in depth about the NSA leaker, the NSA whistleblower.
NSA whistleblower.
I want to say whistleblower because there's people who are trying to push that leaker and whistleblower and source, that all three words mean something very different. And, I mean, I would like to read more. I'm going to read more into that so I could get a real sense of what they're saying is the difference between each word. So I want to make it clear, this guy's a whistleblower. He's not some, like, shady leaker, if
we'll
that's
what
we're
talk about Edward Snowden more.
We'll talk more about him. We'll talk more about his decision to go to Hong Kong. All that and more in the better half. And how do you get into the better half? You become a member. And to become a member, you go to majority.fm, click on Become a Member at the top of the page, and just input your information. It only takes, what, less than 50 cents a day, I believe it is.
It's in the 30s. It's significantly less.
Significantly less, yes.
Become a member. If you want to, make a one-time donation and say that you were so thrilled listening to Matt and Mike Monday that you just needed to make a donation.
That always helps.
Or that you wanted to, that you saw the picture of baby Saul Cedar that we posted on last Friday, and you want to help out. Buy your stuff through Amazon.
The Amazon link, it's on the front page now in the sidebar. Also, subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/user/SamCedar. And the YouTube switched over to the new channel page, and we cannot yet put our link to the live stream, the actual embedded stream on our YouTube page now. So to see our YouTube live stream, you either go to majority.fm and we'll post a link every day on the blog, or you could subscribe also to our official live stream page, which is just for when the show is live. That's at youtube.com/user/majorityreportlive. We're going to the better half.
See you in the better half, folks.